I don't always use the real names of the women who I talk to in this podcast because sometimes they don't want you Googling them. They don't want you stalking them. Sometimes they say things that even people next to them don't know about their lives. Such was the case with this week's person who calls herself Darcy. I let her pick her own name. That's sure, that's fine. It's not that she's ashamed, and we really didn't have that long to talk. This is a conversation recorded in the front seat of her car after she and I went to a 12-step meeting in the park together. And the conversation is about race, it's about religion, it's about politics, all the things you shouldn't talk about, but we talk about them in a different way, just one human to another, not shouting at each other in some kind of food fight. And so it's a case in which she considers how I feel about certain things, like a hot button topic like crime, and I consider how she feels. And we have a genuine human interaction sitting in the front seat of her car where she is literally in the driver's seat. I think you'll enjoy hearing this from Darcy.
We make changes in small ways. And if everybody does something small, if everyone's doing it, then you're going to have an impact.
This is In Her Words, a podcast from manlisting.com. Featuring one man listening to the stories of real women in their own words. In Her Words, a conversation worth hearing because every woman deserves to be heard.
Hey there, hi there, and welcome to In Her Words, the podcast. I'm Stuart Watson. This week, a friend of mine, Darcy, I hope we have her back because we only had 45 minutes, I guess, before she had to get to an appointment in South Park. And so we did everything we could, but we really didn't get into her life that much, which is fascinating. She's a great wife, a great mom, you know, a great family member. You'll hear that. And I hope she'll come back. But in the meantime, we talk about some of the same old things in a completely new and refreshing way. My friend Darcy.
Where were you born?
I was born in Toronto. In Ontario.
That's in Canada.
It is in Canada. All my family was born in Canada with the exception of my brother. My mom and dad were born and raised there. My dad's heritage is Russian. My mom's heritage is Ukraine. And a lot of people migrated to Canada from that part of Europe.
Are they Jewish, Christian?
My daddy was Jewish. He was a non-practicing Jewish. He was, I don't want to say he was an atheist, but he was. Because
Would he say he was an atheist?
Yeah, but I think there was some, a little bit of loneliness in that with him.
Although the atheists are starting to get together now. Yeah. They have a social group.
Daddy was extremely smart. He read a lot, and he was a very, very smart person. So anything that had to do with, you know, facts about how life started and things like that, it just outweighed any kind of spiritual influence in his life. So, and my mom was Greek Orthodox, but didn't practice when she got married. Because Daddy was an atheist, so.
So did you ever go to any religious?
I did.
Where did you go when you were little?
In was it Tarboro? When we lived in Tar? No, it must have been Rocky Mount.
You're required to go to church.
Well, no, but Mom and Dad dropped us off at a synagogue, my sister and I. And then I guess they left and went and got coffee. That was my exposure to formalized religion.
Do you remember any of that?
I don't.
You don't remember any Hebrew? You don't remember?
Mm-mm.
How old were you?
Oh, we were young. I mean, we were, I would say like 10, something like that.
Oh, well,
and then back in those days, you could drop off your kids and leave.
Do you have any kind of feeling about it? Like it was fun or it was boring or it was...
I don't recall that, but I've always had, it's just what I recall from a very early age, I've always had a desire to believe in something and that something was there for me. You know, and I called this thing God, and so it's just the feeling that I had in my heart that something was there for me, someone was there for me. I went to a junior college, which was a church affiliated school, and so we had chapel every Wednesday, and just really didn't, you know, the formalized religion just didn't make too much of an impact on me. A lot of it was just what we had to do. And then fast forwarding a lot of years, I went to a Greek church. Kuykendall is where the church is. And it was a relatively...
Is that North Carolina?
Oh, well, Kuykendall Road.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Here in Charlotte.
Yeah. And I went to that service because I thought, well, my mom was Greek Orthodox, so let's see what that's like. And it was a lovely service. It was very long. There was incense and stuff, and it was neat. The priest was really sweet. But went there, and that was probably the only time I went there, and went to different churches just to kind of see what they were like. And I did not have a connection. I didn't feel really any connection until I went to a church that's now called something, I forget what it's called, but there were a lot of my friends that went to this particular church, and it was quite lovely. It started out quite small, and then it got big to the point where it was televised, or, you know, they had the monitors, you know, the TV screens, and just that in itself, I just didn't care for. I mean, the essence was still there, but I think I'm just kind of old-fashioned in that.
Can you articulate, without me, because I have feelings about the big screens, can you articulate what is lost when you interject bigness, big screens, and...
The intimacy of being with people, you know. I just feel more of a connection. It's much more meaningful when, you know, I'm listening to someone and I'm looking at someone and they're sharing their message to us. It gets lost when it's on a big screen. And you know, the whole idea of spreading the word, I get kind of stumped on that with spreading the word and bigness is better. You know, I just don't agree with that. For instance, there's a church that I've been going to for a couple of years now, and it's a small church. Most of the people who go there are older people. I'm one of two white people that go there. And
they're black.
Yeah. And it's an old-fashioned church. It's so lovely. And I started going there because one of my girlfriends invited me to come. And at that time, that was, God, I've been going longer than that, because my mom died in 2019. At the end of the service, she had passed on my name and my mom's name to the pastor. And they gave a shout out to me and my mom's name, you know, let's pray for Elsie. And I was so touched by that. It was such a sweet act, you know, for them to do. And that kind of sold me on it. And
was your girlfriend black?
Yes.
And, you know, a lot of people, white people, would feel uncomfortable. Like if you're the only white person, it's...
Well, the tables are turned, see how...
Yeah,
it feels.
I mean, people, but white people are not accustomed to that.
Well, one thing that I am eternally grateful to my parents, and my siblings will attest to this, is that coming from Canada, moving to North Carolina in 1965, maybe. As we were growing up, they had a preconceived notion of a prejudice in the South, and they kind of had a preconceived notion of ignorance in the South. And my mom told us kids, she said, there are two words you'll never say in this house. One is shut up, and the other is the N-word. And that just, I mean, so I never grew up with, and even, you know, back then, I mean, the schools were, you know, integrated. And God, when I was going into ninth grade, whatever year that would have been, it just wasn't part of me. It just wasn't, you know, and it was never problematic for me. And so going to this church and experiencing what was the truth about that church, and the truth about that church is that there's kindness and there's acceptance and there's love. And that's what shined through.
You know, what's interesting is in the Canadian culture, there's a huge problem with the First Nations. But everything I've heard of Toronto is that Toronto is more diverse than New York City.
Yes, and I think that's true.
And maybe it's just that I don't hear about it because I don't live in Toronto or in Canada, but Siri has been listening. I apologize. I'll delete her. I don't hear about a black man being choked to death over selling single cigarettes in Toronto. How is it that culture developed? Do you know? I mean, am I just making that up?
I don't think you're making it up, but we were very young when we left Toronto. So, you know, Toronto is my birthplace, but, you know, 5-6 years old is when we moved to North Carolina. So, you know, any of those social, you know, experiences just weren't mine because I was just too young. Mm. I have an older sister who was what?
Do you have dual citizenship?
I do.
Have you ever been tempted to?
I was until I wasn't until
like
the government.
When were you tempted?
Not really tempted, but I viewed Canada as being an accepting place. You know, crime was lower. There was, you know, diversity. And then you got the nutcases that were in office, and I can't even think of who they are now. But
they're still
yeah. But I mean, I never got to a place in my thinking that moving somewhere else was better than where I'm living. I mean, you know, bar all sorts of issues and problems that we've got in this country, it's the best country in the world to live in.
What do you love about Charlotte?
Probably the friends that I've made here. Mm-hmm. I mean, Charlotte's getting bigger and, you know, crime's going up. And
I don't know that's true.
Well, it is from what I heard on the radio this morning that we have 36 murders to date, and this date last year was 25. That's an increase in crime.
It is an increase in a certain type of crime. You are correct. Here's a question for you. What, if anything, do you think anyone or any system can do about a murder rate? Like, what would make a definite impact on the murder rate, do you think? Do you think that's something within our control?
Good gravy. What a question.
Like, if only that were illegal.
Yeah, but, you know, talking this morning about, you know, how store employees are instructed not to apprehend anyone who's shoplifting, and then kind of digressing a little bit, you see the crime that takes place in some of these other cities with, you know, the drugstores, and people just come in and ransack. I mean, that's way problematic. That's mm-hmm. hugely problematic. Squatters. What are squatters' rights? You know, those things to me, there's such a lack of common sense and such a lack of independent thinking. And it's like, you know, there is a system of laws in place, and that's what we abide by. And if you break the law, then there's punishment to, you know, to fit that. And so,
once upon a time, to kind of push back, which I probably shouldn't. Once upon a time, not that terribly long ago, everyone was a squatter.
Okay, so expound a little bit.
Well,
I mean, like how long ago? Like centuries?
Yeah, but I mean, in the course of sort of human events, the notion of private property was, you know. Now, if someone was you know, attacking you or, you know, killing you or something, but if someone were quietly taking a few fish out of your stream,
that's okay. I don't mind somebody fishing in my stream.
Yeah, it's
when that's it, quite this different is a, from a home that you own that you're trying to sell, and people go in and vandalize and change the locks and it's, and they're not paying rent. I mean, that's a problem.
It can be. This is, I'm dangerously close to channeling my children, which will get us really far afield about the concept of taking and owning and everything else and who owns anything and how kind of absurd it is to think that you own land.
Well, I kind of understand where you're coming from to a degree, but like I shared earlier, you know, I've got a bit of a challenge with black and white thinking, but the American dream, if I'm working and I'm working hard and I'm saving money and I've saved enough money to buy a home or to buy a second home and, you know, where was I going with that? Then it's problematic for someone to move into the home that I worked hard for just because they need a place to live and, or.
I think it's problematic to force that.
To force what?
To force someone to accept someone. That's highly problematic. So if you work for something and then someone else just comes and takes what it is that you've worked on without your permission, that's highly problematic. Yes, you're correct. Well,
and I don't know that there's that's a situation that I have to accept. I mean...
It depends on what you mean by accept.
Well, what did you mean when you say the it's problematic as far as the acceptance part?
It's hard to accept.
It is. I mean, kind of to me, the way it sounds like you're kind of alluding to is and this is something that we all are familiar with, the whole theory of acceptance, accepting everything, and that's a real tall order, you know. In a perfect world, yes, but we don't live in a perfect world. We're far from it, and our reality is there are dangerous people. There are people who have, you know, no respect for other people's. Not feelings, but just property or I know what I'm trying to say, but I think in theory those things are good, but it's just like world peace thing, you know, trying to make peace with countries that, you know, hate us to the core and would think nothing about annihilating us. Well, you know, kiss and hug and embrace is just not going to do anything with people like that, with that kind of thinking. So, you know, I think you have to take that into account, that this is the world that we live in. And so
you can't cuddle a rattlesnake.
True.
I get you. But let me, I think what I'm getting at is less political than it is a kind of a spiritual tenet, mm-hmm. of we have to have some kind of grasp on this world, the material world. I'm not saying we don't. I mean, I don't want, you know, all of a sudden a gang of homeless people to just break down my door. The question becomes how tight that grip is and how resistant I am, how much I want to cling to any given thing. How tight a grip I need to have before it starts to hurt my hand. I start to cramp up. Do you see what I'm saying?
I do see what you're saying. I do see what you're saying. And again, to me, that's kind of like, if everybody had that way of thinking, then there's a lot of problems that would be solved. You know, releasing that tight grip on material things.
Or the notion that something is a problem, mm-hmm. like labeling something a problem. Like, it's not my problem if a huge commercial enterprise wants to have a policy to allow shoplifting with impunity. It's not my problem. So why do I have to use any of my bandwidth to come up with a position on that? It's like,
well, if we all took that position that it's not my problem, then we wouldn't have any solutions. I mean, nothing would.
We also wouldn't have any problems.
Well, yeah, that's that's a little bit too far out there for me. Because it's kind of like when we see a crime, you know, if you see a crime being committed and you step away, it's the crime is not doing something. It's the crime is not wanting to get involved because, you know, you just don't want to go there.
Well, we had an instance right here in the park where we have our little meeting in a public park. There might be 9 people. And one day there was a terribly mentally disturbed individual who took one of the big mag lights and came and began ranting and beating on one of our older members, beating on his arm, his hand, to where he drew blood. And so he gets bear tackled and the cops get called. And the cops kind of encourage you. They're like, we know this individual. They almost encouraged the prosecution. And the person who was beat on said, nope, he's just a sick and suffering individual. Whereas when he was pistol whipped in a robbery, he would prosecute. So, you know, we are always at choice and selective about who we choose to sort of be angry at and prosecute and administer justice to, and who we choose to, you know, let go and go with God. You know, you're on your journey.
There was a situation, this has been a few years back, I read about it, or maybe it was on the news, but there was a young kid, high schooler, who had a gun, and I don't recall, you know, if he had committed crimes with shooting or anything, but one of the teachers, one of the guidance counselors, somebody approached him and was able to calm him down enough to where this person was talking with him, and this person embraced him. Mm-hmm. Embraced him because, and it was a female, she just recognized the pain and the hurt in someone that young to be doing what he was doing. And I guess she took a chance really with her safety, but that was what resonated with her, and it melted his aggression. And I thought, what a lovely thing to do, and how helpful that was. And there are some people that would have completely said, you know, he's got a gun and blah, blah, blah. And with the incident that you're talking about with somebody coming, beating somebody with this light. It's your normal reaction to protect yourself or to get away from danger. I'm not sure where I'm going with that either. Thinking about like race relations and things, and you know, the media, how much they kind of pump us with toxic stuff and untruths. But I feel that if one were to ask people of different, you know, backgrounds, you know, whether you're white or black or Asian or Native American, I think, at least this is what I believe, that the majority of people would say, you know, we do pretty good, you know, that we get along pretty good. There's certainly, you know, situations where there's racially motivated actions and things like that. But I think one thing that we can do in a troubled situation, world that we live in right now and in this country is, you know, when we're in a store, when we're in a public place, that, you know, you make eye contact with someone and you smile and you engage in small talk. And that's usually reciprocated. At least it's been my experience. You know, you say something nice to somebody and or just anything, and there's usually an exchange. And, you know, being grateful for people who are taking care of, you know, the stores that we're in, you know, people that are salespeople, and how far it goes when one recognizes their their efforts and doing their job, and you say, you know, thank you or whatever. Those things go a long way. And
holding the door for someone,
anything like that, it's just
letting someone go ahead of you.
Yeah. It just, and it makes you feel good. You know, you certainly, at least I think, you know, have a satisfied feeling with having that connection. I mean, we're wired for connection. And so, you know, when you look at all the you know, electronics and things that people have, and it's just so easy not to engage with people. It's not how we're hardwired. We are hardwired for connection.
What has been the evolution of how you pray? Like, so you go to this temple or synagogue in a place where there are not many Jewish people at all, those tiny Jewish communities in eastern North Carolina and in the rural South. Once upon a time in the Mississippi Delta and South Georgia, where I came from, there were these Jewish congregations. And they're shrinking down to nothing. As one guy said, more, you know, more funeral services than there are weddings or like a bris or a celebration of a new life, a baby. How has your prayer evolved? What does it look like now? And what did it look like when you were like a young woman and then also as a girl?
I honestly don't remember what my prayer, I mean, we didn't grow up in a, you know, formalized religion. We did not go to church. That was not part of my upbringing at all.
But I mean, did you ever say thanks for the food or
nothing,
ever,
no blessings like that. I mean, nothing at the table.
Did you ever say, please, dear God, help me pass the math exam?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I mean,
Well, that's a prayer.
Well,
that
it is
counts.
A prayer. It is a prayer. And today, you know, my prayer life is, and it's been helpful to have, you know, routineness. I do like getting on my knees. I feel like it's a more personal, I don't know if respectful is the right way, but whatever it is that I'm praying to, I just prefer to get on my knees and bow my head, and it just feels right to me. And my prayers mostly really are prayers of gratitude. You know, thank you for keeping, you know, my family safe. Thank you for your grace and your mercy.
How does that grace and mercy look? What like family I get? Family safe I get, safe from disease, safe from car accidents, etc. Grace and mercy is more murky.
It is, and I think, you know, just our humanness, the human condition, you know, when you know, I say something unkind or hurt someone's feelings or, you know, don't give someone, you know, the attention that maybe I needed to. I get really, and those are probably kind of mild things, but I guess just the grace and the mercy for the human condition, you know. I mean, as far as, you know, with recovery, I mean, there were many times, like many people who are in active addiction, you know, pray to God, you know, please help me, please help me. And I never, ever, ever thought, you know, the God of my understanding has deserted me. Why is this still happening? It just wasn't part of my thinking. It wasn't part of my core. I didn't know why that I wasn't staying in consistent recovery. I mean, I probably know to some degree, but it wasn't because God had left me. That's never the case. God is always, the God of our understanding is always, always with us.
Accessible.
Yeah.
So how, going back to the prayer question, how do you access God?
Well, through prayer and during the day I talk to God. I was going to say something, it just went away.
I apologize.
That's okay. I'm just thinking for a second. I mean, it's just always been the way I have felt in my heart of hearts that, you know, my prayers, our prayers, that I do them, but I have to be prepared for the outcome. You know, if you know, keeping my family safe, if that happens today, that they're still safe, then I'm grateful for that, and I thank God for keeping them safe. And I'll say the same thing again, then, you know, tomorrow. But if something tragic were going to happen, I don't blame God for it. It's just
There's probably someone somewhere saying the Tar Heels lost last night.
Oh, my gosh.
Therefore, God doesn't exist.
But there's a lot of situations where people, you know, look at that, like, if there is a God, why is this happening? And it's like, it just, it's so vast and it's so beyond my, not even jurisdiction, but just my thinking to blame God for anything. I just don't. I feel that there's an encompassing love that's just hard to really put into words. And as long as I continue to be grateful and express gratitude and do the next right thing and you know, service work, whether service work to me is a multitude of things. I've gotten to a habit of rounding up grocery carts. It used to piss me off, and it probably still does. But how many people are in the parking lot at Walmart, and you know, you see the carts, and you put those away, and then my peripheral vision will get, you know, and I'll say, am I going to go get it? And then while I'm walking to get it, but that makes me feel good.
Well, let me tell you something. You're a hop, skip, and a jump from putting the grocery cart back in someone else's to world peace. I'll tell you, it's not that far. I can't affect world peace. I can just put one more grocery cart back.
But you think about it, and this is what I tell my daughter, and it's like, you know, how can we make a change? Well, we make changes in small ways. And if everybody does something small, if everyone's doing it, then you're going to have an impact. And so what does that look like, you know, when I'm on the beach or when I'm walking and you see people do this, picking up trash, you know, mm-hmm. have a pair of gloves in the car and some trash bags and do those things and round up grocery carts and talk to people. That's all the stuff that we can do that's very easy to do and it's impactful if we do it.
I think about this. Men are notorious for peeing on the toilet seat. And so I've broken it down into, are you a person who pees on the toilet seat, does not pee on the toilet seat, is willing to clean the toilet seat for the person who comes after you?
Well, you know,
or are you just going to be mad and call the manager?
Yeah, but I mean, if I'm going to pee on the toilet seat,
women don't do that, by the way. They're superior.
Well, women. No, but I mean, if let's say you're in a public place, many women will not sit on the seat, so they just, you know, kind of keep themselves off the seat. Yeah, they levitate.
I've often suspected women levitate.
But there can be, you know, pee all over the seat. Well, the right thing to do is to clean up your mess, whether you're a guy or a girl. Hmm. I mean, that's just what you do.
No, I'm talking about one farther. Do you clean up someone else's mess?
Well, if I'm going to use the toilet, if I'm going to even sit there, then what you do is you get paper towel or you get Kleenex.
That's what you do.
Well,
some people would just complain to the management or like never go there again or go scream at whoever it was.
Well, that's the kind of thinking that I think, you know, if you get out of that thinking and it's, thank goodness that that's not my thinking. You know, my thinking is, if I'm going to use the toilet, I'm going to wipe it up with you know, toilet tissue and keep my hands away from that, wipe it up, and then go about my business. But I don't know. What's the point of complaining about something like that to a manager? I mean, there's things that, you know, warrant, you know, bringing that the manager's attention to something, like if, you know, I don't know.
I think you're... I've dragged us into the bathroom, literally, but there's something about the minutiae of the everydayness of having to practice spirituality in these things that we're required to do. If I don't pee, my body's going to be poisoned and I'm going to die. So it is, so given that I have to do that as a function of living, how can I do it in a way, how can I practice these lofty aspirations in the most mundane? I think Mother Teresa called it God in all his wretchedness.
And, you know, we go about our day, and I think maybe when you get a little bit older, maybe this is a little easier, you know, how we talk about, you know, being in the moment and just being present, you know, and so if the mundane that we encounter each day, if we approach the mundane in a way that is satisfactory to how my day goes, how I function, then that's a good thing. You know, getting up in the morning and getting ready for work and all that kind of stuff, but just anything that I encounter, whether it's, you know, traffic or, you know, somebody in the grocery store or whatever, something that's a little bit problematic, then you make it work. You know, you start doing those kind of selfless things and it becomes more of how you function, which is a much more pleasing way to go about my day than you know, being a complainer.
You mentioned your father being an atheist, but I gather he was not an anarchist. And so what is the practical reason beyond God for cleaning up your own mess? Like, what is the ethic? If you take God out of it, what is the philosophy or ethic of, you know, why do anything that is remotely selfless? Why do it?
Well, why not? I mean,
because
it's too easy to get self-absorbed in everything, and anything is just about what's going on in my vision, my field of vision, and you miss everything. Mm. You miss everything that way. So, and maybe it's a little bit easier for me because I'm kind of wired that way. Maybe to a fault to some degree as far as.
Because you're a mom?
No.
Because women are inherently more nurturing?
And I don't even like to say that either, that women are more nurturing. I think women are more balanced than men. I think women are more in the driver's seat because they have the capacity to multitask and they don't have, generally speaking, the egos that men do. So they tend to be more successful in solutions, I think.
Or that ego manifests itself in a different way.
Mm-hmm. But I think I'm a nurturer by nature, whether it's having, you know, a child or being the mom to two cats or anything like that. I think it's just part of my makeup. What was the question before?
Well, this goes to the, you know, are we genetically selfish or selfless, altruistic? And I think we're both. And like, if you give up everything, then you're pretty soon dead and a martyr, and you've like killed yourself off. So there's some things we're going to have to do. I mean, I took two sausage biscuits this morning. I didn't need to, but I wasn't taking it from anyone else because there were plenty left over.
Is there a problem with that?
I don't know. I feel a little guilty.
Well, not because you were taken away from someone else, that maybe you just didn't need two sausage biscuits. But you wanted them, so there's nothing wrong with that. Nobody else, everyone else got one.
My wife would tell you there's something wrong with it because I'm feeding my obesity. But let me frame it this way. How do you personally engage in self-care in a way that is not selfish? So, time spent with your horse, that's not selfish, that's wonderful.
Self-care is never selfish, And I think it's important that people really understand the importance of self-care.
Don't talk to me about people. Talk to me about you. What does self-care look like for Darcy?
Self-care for me is taking care of myself, by way of just physically, making sure that I'm well rested if I need to sleep in the morning, or if I need to not commit to something, or I think there's maybe a little bit of a dance that you need to kind of go through to figure out what's true self-care, as opposed to maybe being a little bit not self-absorbed, but I just make sure that I'm mentally, emotionally, physically in a good place. And if I'm not, then I try to do something about it.
Most of that is abstraction. When you were a new mom, it's frickin' exhausting, overwhelming, it's hard to sleep. How did you do it when you were a new mom, and how would you do it differently if you were a mom now? What would you tell your daughter if she became a new mom?
That it's important to have a village, whether it's your significant other,
grandmas, or aunties, like how it used to be.
And how did I practice self-care when my daughter was an infant? I didn't, and I think most new parents agree with that. That you kind of go on autopilot. You just do what needs to be done. You do what needs to be done, and you have to have the help of others. And I remember many times when my husband would come home, he would work out of town, and so I might be with our daughter for 3-4 days, and he'd come home, and I would just be sobbing, probably mostly because I was sleep deprived, and so he would take over, and I would sleep in the spare bedroom, and he would come in when our daughter was ready to nurse, and that's how I, got that self-care back in. But
well, we only have 3 minutes. If we got struck by lightning today and the only thing that survived was this little recording, what is your legacy?
What is my legacy? God, that's a hard question. Can you rephrase it?
Who knows you best in this world that's still living?
My sister.
If she could keep it together, what would she say that you brought to this world during this particular incarnation?
She would say compassion. And I do try to show that. And I'll get teary, I don't know why, but it's just important for us to, it's important to just have that care for other people and to show kindness, just to show kindness. there was a friend of mine who was 102 when she died, and I was friends with her for about, I guess, about 4 years, and I had such a lovely friendship with her. And I did for her. It gave me great joy to do for her, but it also gave me joy to make sure that she had what she needed and that she was cared for. And it's just what I did, because I don't want to sound righteous, but it was the right thing to do. I mean, she's 100, you know, if she needs something, I needed to do it for her.
That's beautiful.
Well, I appreciate your asking me to do this. It would be nice to maybe continue some other time.
I would very much like that.
Yeah. We're sitting in my car because it was chilly, and I have a time constraint this morning, so I guess that's going to be it.
God bless you.
Well, I'm going to give you a hug.
Oh, aren't you sweet? front seat hug. Thank you, ma'am.
Well, so maybe we can do this some other time as well.
I would like it.
Yeah.
Yes.
Thank you, Darcy, and please do come back. You know, don't run away. I still have your number. You still have my number. Let's do this again. Let's get into your bio some more, because a fascinating life, a life of resilience, of overcoming, of having a second life, a second chance through recovery. One of my great, great passions, because we literally see miracles happen. We really do. And the tragedies we see are the price we pay for seeing the miracles, such as hers, a whole new life. Thanks, Darcy.
In Her Words is a production of the Queen City Podcast Network in cooperation with Balto Creative Media. Allison Andrews at Andrews Creative, Rachel Clapp Miller and Roshonda Pratt are developmental producers. Sally Higgins at Higgins & Owens tries to keep us legal. Our music is A Day at the Park by the group Pictures of the Floating World. Your announcer is Catherine Smith. That's me. If you like what you hear, please subscribe and take a moment to rate and review. It really helps others find us. If you love us, go to our Patreon page at patreon.com. Look for Man Listening, one word, no spaces. A small investment makes a big difference in lifting up the voices of women.
Thank you for all the support you have given me from the very beginning for manlistening.com, In Her Words, the podcast. And also now for my newest venture, Voice Locket. Check it out, voicelocket.com. Thanks so much.
Thank you for your support. We believe one voice can change the conversation. Thanks so much.